Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. We provide this call for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood, Investment Directors Greg Hudlevsky, David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeffrey Tengus. With that, I'll pass the call on to David Lundgren, who will serve as the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to our special edition. On today's call, we'll be recapping 2015 and probably a little bit more importantly, giving you our outlook on 2016. And I think where we'll start is kind of a recap of 2015. And I think the best approach is to maybe kind of walk around the room figuratively, and maybe each one of our guests or speakers today will give us a little insight on 2015. And John, I'll start with you, and I guess the question or I think what would be important to communicate to our listeners is, you know, what is the biggest impact item of 2015 in your opinion, and why? Why was it a big impact to the markets and or economy?
Great. Thanks, Dave. In my opinion, the continual decline in commodity prices, actually it's been going on for a number of years, but particularly in 2015, the decline in commodity prices was a significant event and indicative of the deflationary forces and the pressure on prices. Tradable goods prices and really prices of a lot of other products that's going on. I'm looking right now this morning at some continuous commodity returns year to date. This happens to be through December 29. There are about 30-odd commodities listed here, everything from agricultural prices to manufactured goods prices, industrial product prices, and so forth and so on. The S&P 500 index is thrown into this mix as well, just for comparison purposes, and we know the S&P 500 index had relatively flat performance in 2015. If you want to know what won the day, I guess, in the commodity area, if you want to include the S&P 500 index in that, it was orange juice, cocoa, cotton, and sugar, some agricultural commodities that actually had a positive return for the year. Further down the list, of course, you look at copper, down considerably for the year, about 28%. Brent crude, obviously a big source of concern, down about 38% of the year. Anything related to crude and industrial metals, of course, was down near the bottom of the list. It was interesting that agricultural products, live cattle, hogs, everything just about had a negative year in 2015. The disturbing thing about the decline in commodity prices continuing in 2015 is the fact that commodity prices peaked in 2011. Certainly industrial commodity prices did. Oil peaked maybe 2012, as I remember, but commodities generally have been in a declining trends for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm looking here at some five-year data through December 29, same type of mix. S&P 500 in this case, on a total return basis, not annualized, is up a little more than 60% in the last 5 years, and you've got cattle and cocoa and a few things at the top. But again, you've got most of the commodities in negative trends or showing negative returns for the last 5 years. Crude oil, Brent crude, propane is at the bottom, as you might imagine, with a decline exceeding 60% for the last 5 years. But generally, the bottom line is that we had a significant decline in commodity prices, generally, particularly oil and industrial metals last year. It's been going on now for the better part of 5 years, and the implications, of course, are deflationary, and those who have listened to us talk about this sort of thing for the last few years have heard me bring this up before. We appear now to have reached the point where it is generally accepted that this decline in commodities has been fairly significant, and now we're in the transition phase where people try to figure out what to do because of it and how to protect their companies and their profits and their sales and so forth in what appears to be a world of relatively low commodity prices. I was looking back at some data yesterday and thinking about what to talk about today in relation to commodity prices. And a few months ago, the bank credit analyst was looking at the different industrial sectors of the economy, different sectors of the economy in general, really, not just industrial, to see what deflation and the deflationary impulse that was spreading out of the commodity producers around the world was having on our economy. And they found that nearly half of the industry groups were suffering a contraction in selling prices, with two-thirds unable to raise selling prices by more than 1%. And then you had some others that were able to raise prices at less than a 2% annual rate. So it's had a significant impact, like throwing a pebble in the water. You've got some ripples that are spreading out from the decline in commodity prices that are probably impacting not only every business that is involved in industrial production, but probably the service economy as well. And so that, I think, is a fairly significant event. We don't know exactly how long this might last. I mean, certainly it's well advanced. At least we certainly hope it is well advanced. But the fallout continues, and we'll probably see more fallout in 2016.
Okay. Thank you, John. Jeffrey Tangus, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think? Biggest headliner of 2015?
That's an easy one for me. It's got to be the Federal Reserve. If you think back about what took place in 2015, the Federal Reserve was beating the drum on rate increases going back to the end of last year. And so they have continued to beat the drum, but took no action actually until December, just recently. They finally got up the gumption to make a move. So the Fed has a bit of a flair for the dramatic, certainly. They like to talk about raising rates a lot more than they actually like to do it, apparently. So in December, they finally got around to raising rates to the surprise of almost no one, actually. The increase was rather modest, about 25 basis points. Again, largely anticipated. We know that because after they announced the increase, the markets moved very little. I think the 25 basis point increase translated into maybe Fed funds moving from 15 basis points to 35 basis points, still extremely low historically. And so, again, the market was largely anticipating all of this move. The vote that the Fed took was unanimous, and that that generally means that they're leaning more in a hawkish way. So they've got a unanimous board now that I guess believes that rates need to go up. The reasons that they cite are the same reasons they talked about all year, that the labor market with unemployment down around 5% now had showed considerable improvement, and the Fed was also feeling better that they were going to be able to get inflation up to their target of 2%. I'll repeat that. The Fed will be able to get inflation up to 2% because, as we know, they've been trying all they've been trying and waiting for inflation to rear its ugly head, but no success so far. Especially because of the decline in commodity prices that John talked about. The Fed also has indicated all year and reemphasized it again in December that any increases that they make will be gradual in nature. I think the market took a great deal of comfort in that. And then finally, if we look at what the Fed, they poll and survey each one of the Fed members. They call it the dot plot. Where do you think rates are going to be at the end of this year and next year and the year after? And if we take a quick look at that, we know that the Fed anticipates essentially four increases this year of 25 basis points each, and then four in 2017, again, of 25 basis points each. Fairly modest. That only gets you to about 2.4% at the end of 2017, very low on historical standards. So there, I guess, from our view of the world, we think that the Fed will probably raise slower than that, not faster, because of sluggishness around the world. But essentially, the Fed played the role of Donald Trump, in my mind, in a lot of ways, because they just wouldn't let people talk about anything else but the Fed for most of the year.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
So we've got the Fed. We have oil, commodity prices. What else in 2015 was a big impact to the market, in your opinion?
To me, I think three things. I would second Jeff's Federal Reserve. I mean, they were, you know, expected to raise rates, and I think, you know, every time they put it out further and further, that just created more uncertainty in the equity markets. And there was a lot of debate over the year whether or not the economy was really still strong enough to be able to support higher interest rates. So I think that certainly was key. Greece, although it's been in the news for 5 years or more, continued to garner headlines, economically kind of insignificant. A Greece exit would be a political blow, in my opinion, to the European Union. And I think that whole concept of a unified currency that could compete against the dollar. So, you know, I think there was a lot of political dancing going on to try and get Greece to do some kind of, you know, austerity measures. But earlier in the year, the anti-austerity party won. But it does generate a level of instability, and it spilled over into the markets, even though its economic influence is small. And certainly tying in with commodities, China's been a big issue. If you look at just the size of China's economy and how much it's garnering of the global economy, it's gotten fairly large. And just to kind of support what John was talking about on commodity consumption, back in 2000, they had less than 20% of global commodity consumption. Now it's over 40%. Steel consumption went from something like 17% to almost 47%. Oil consumption was roughly under 10%, probably around 6%, and that shot up to about 12%. So, you know, it's become a bigger and bigger player, and even though the U.S. doesn't really have a significant economic impact directly with China, a lot of the emerging market economies do have a direct impact. And so, you know, I think there was a lot of concern, you know, when these things start. And, you know, we saw it yesterday with the Shanghai market selling off, that it kind of cascades and snowballs around the globe. And that even when there's really no fundamental economic justification, you still experience the volatility of global equity markets just because they're so interconnected these days. So those are my top three.
All right, Luther, can you top the three we heard so far?
I think so. I think mine is the easiest and impacted the most people, and that is the fact that last year there really was no place to go. There was a distinct lack of market breadth last year. What that means is your average stock did not do very well. If you go back, and what I'm going to use is the S&P 500 equal weighted, meaning each of the constituents has an equal weight, versus the S&P 500 cap weighted, which is the opposite, meaning, of course, the larger your market capitalization, the more you count towards the index. Since 12/31/1999, or close to the peak in the dot-com bubble, the S&P 500 has a cumulative return over the 15 years of 39.11% or 4% per year. If you look at the S&P 500 equal-weighted, you get a much different picture, and that those stocks are up 172% versus that 39. The idea here is that over time, the average stock does better than the largest capitalization stocks. And we know historically that, you know, small-cap stocks outperform mid-cap stocks, which outperform large-cap stocks. And there are a number of reasons for that, but we won't get into that at this point in time. But last year, kind of the opposite happened. in our last investment piece, we wrote about FANG, which was, you know, a a look back at the market and how only a few stocks overall did very well. You know, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, those all did well. But if you look at those same indexes for last year, you see that the S&P 500, and this is price only, had a negative return of minus 0.7%, whereas the average stock, the S&P 500 equal weighted, was down 4%. Another way to look at it, which really tells the best story about large cap stocks outperforming the index as a whole and everything else doing poorly, is that on a price only basis, the 10 largest capitalization weighted stocks in the index had a return of plus 18%. And we mentioned the S&P 500 cap weighted itself was minus 1% or minus 0.7. And then the average stock, or the other 90 stocks in the index on a capitalization weighted basis, were down 5%. So plus 18 for the biggest 10 and minus 5 for the other 490 stocks in the S&P 500. So it was a very difficult year. Last year there were only two stocks in the S&P 500 that doubled, which is very unusual. But overall, if you didn't own the biggest stocks last year, you didn't have a good year.
Okay. Thank you all. Good review of 2015. And Luther, we'll stick with you. And let's talk a little bit about going forward here in 2016. What do you think of the pressing issues going to be? And, you know, what would be a positive outcome for either the market and or economy?
I think the pressing issue goes back to what Jeff talked about, and that is that what is the Fed going to do this year? And he mentioned that the anticipation is that they'll raise interest rates 0.25%, 4 times, or each quarter end throughout the course of 2016. If you look at the dot plots or the Federal Reserve members' estimates of where they think rates are going to be, they have rates rising 1% in 16, 1% in 17, and 1% in 18. However, that is, as they have said, very data-dependent. It depends upon the underlying economic fundamentals. To a certain extent, it will also be determined by what happens in global markets. We know last year they delayed one of the rate increases because of what was happening in China. We'll have to see how that goes this year. We'll have to see also the strength in the dollar. Will that continue to put a damper on our economy? You know, over the last few years, if you forecasted that the economy was going to pick up speed for any number of reasons, lower interest rates, lower fuel prices, wage pressures on the upside, you haven't seen it. You've been wrong. We've had that, you know, flat 2 to 2.5% growth now for like 5 years. On the other hand, if you look for a recession, you've been wrong too. So it looks like we're going to continue to see slow to moderate growth, and maybe instead of 4 rate increases a year, we have 2 or 3, but it's all really going to depend upon the underlying economic strength and what happens in the global economies. But I would look to see that the Fed will raise rates this year. I think that's fully anticipated by the market. It shouldn't have a huge impact. We have to remember that right now the Fed's fund rate is in a range of 25 to 50 basis points. If they raise interest rates by 1%, it still keeps interest rates at a very low historical number. So I think that could be positive for this year. If we raise more than 4 times, we could have some negative impact, but that just doesn't look like it's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you, Luther. Greg, how about you?
The way just looking at earnings, you know, last year the earnings decline for the fourth quarter of 2015 is probably going to come in around a negative 5%. If that's the case, it'll be the first time we've seen 3 consecutive quarters of year-over-year declines in earnings since the mortgage crisis back in 2009. At the end of the third quarter, September 30th last year, estimate revisions were nearly flat, so we've seen some significant revisions just over the last 3 months, and primarily led by the materials sector. Keep in mind that much of that downward revision have been due to the result of a stronger dollar. The stronger dollar, of course, has an impact on both 2015 and 2016, and that makes our exports less competitive and makes earnings translations from overseas earnings lower. So you know, the strong dollar certainly has taken a toll on those estimate revisions. So it's not all necessarily that we've seen reductions in sales. You know, some of it has been that. But for the most part, however, it looks like, at least looking forward, earnings in 2016 could be up from 2015 levels. The majority of sectors are reporting increases. All of these are showing a trend up: consumer discretionary, financials, utilities, consumer staples, materials, and even energy are showing potential increases. Technology is also showing that, but that is primarily driven by Apple and Google. If you remove those two stocks, basically it suggests flat earnings in the technology area, but discretionary is indicating an 8 to 14% increase in 2016. Financials, 7 to 9%. If you look at the overall S&P, less energy, 5% for 2015, 8% for 2016. Looking at technology again, from 4 to 9%, but again, due to those two stocks of Google and Apple. Utilities from about 1% to 3%. If you just look at the overall S&P 500, it's really a negative earnings for 2015, a minus 2%, but again, an 8% increase for 2016. And then consumer staples from negative 3% to 6%, materials from minus 10 to 11%, and of course energy, which is, you know, took the biggest whacking last year, negative 59% for 2015, which is just huge, but moving up, but still negative at a negative 10% for 2016. Telecom services basically are looking at reductions from 16 to 6%. Healthcare also down from about 13% to 9%. Industrials flat from about 4% to 4%. And, of course, at the beginning of the year, earnings estimates are always overly optimistic, so you can expect, you know, some downward revisions going forward. And, of course, you know, if the economy does slow further, that, you know, that ultimately will impact. But that's the way the picture looks on the earnings front right now.
Okay, thank you, Greg. John Portwood, most pressing issue for 2016.
From an economic standpoint, I guess it's, do we have a recession or do we continue the, you know, relatively slow growth trend that we've experienced since 2009? And normally, or I say normally, let's go back, you know, historically the economists look at all the historic numbers and come up with the idea that recessions in the past have never started unless you had some sort of excess that needed to be corrected. Either the Federal Reserve steps in and raises interest rates and reduces credit availability and so forth and so on to calm down an overheated economy, or perhaps some particular shock arrives that was unexpected and creates a recession and so forth and so on. There really is, outside of Japan, no precedent for what we see currently, which is a very low inflation, low interest rate environment with relatively fragile growth compared to what we've seen during recoveries in the past. And assuming that interest rates stay relatively low and inflation stays relatively low, the general thinking is that a recession is probably unlikely, but Japan is probably the poster child, I guess, for periodic recessions and slumps in economic activity in the midst of a deflationary episode, even though the Japanese central bank is pumping like crazy and trying to get things off the floor. So it's really a little bit, more than a little bit difficult to try to, you know, project recessions these days. And, in fact, it's becoming so difficult from the standpoint of economic indicators that used to be used fairly regularly by most of the forecasters, that leading economic indicator models are being reset. The Conference Board Index that produces the leading economic indicator series that everybody looks at all the time is removing money supply and some other things from their index that to make it more relevant, I guess, to what's happening currently. The American Institute for Economic Research has dropped the yield curve. Their research has shown that the yield curve now does not have any validity, really, in suggesting whether we're about to have a recession or not. So where are we now looking at the new models? Well, they haven't changed appreciably. They're still positive. They suggest recession is not necessarily around the corner, but they're all flirting with relatively low levels, suggesting that we probably can't be certain that we will avoid recession. In the past, high inflation has and high interest rates, of course, have generated recessionary periods, and I suppose the Fed could make a mistake and raise rates too much and create some problems, but assuming that doesn't happen, then we're probably okay in terms of the future. So my guess is that recession is probably not likely, given the current numbers. However, the flow of data is not particularly encouraging. If you look at coincident indicators of economic activity, there are two I look at in particular. One is produced by the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, and the other is something relatively new. It's maybe 3 years old, produced by the Atlanta Fed, called a GDP Now number. Those two indicators have consistently generated poorer results throughout 2015 compared to 2014, and they both ended the year on negative notes. The GDP Now number from the Atlanta Fed, the number that just came out yesterday, suggests that the fourth quarter GDP was around 0.7%. That's probably the lowest reading that we've seen in the Atlanta GDP Now number, where they're trying to estimate GDP for a quarter, in quite some time. It's not precisely accurate, but it certainly suggests that the fourth quarter was not a barn burner by any means. The ADS indicator also shows that in particular, the latter part of 2015 was much worse than the latter part of 2014. So looking at those two indicators, the way they stand today, and trying to project those into the early part of next year, it would appear that next year has the potential on the whole to be weaker than this year. This year it looks like a 2% GDP number, I guess. The consensus estimate for next year is about 2.5. My guess would be that it's probably going to be 2, or perhaps it could be even lower than 2. Without recession, possibly, or probably, let's call it probably, without recession. But it's a tricky period. The numbers are not particularly exciting. There's no need to be unduly alarmed, I guess, about recession at this point. But certainly the possibility is there, and it's just something that we'll have to look at very carefully going forward.
Okay. Thanks, Sean. Jeff. What do you think the pressing issue for 2016 will be, in addition to the ones already discussed?
Well, to me, I look at our consumption-based economy, and I think that we've got to get wage growth, wage inflation, call it whatever you want, into this economy, because essentially we're a consumption economy, and if people don't have money, extra money to spend, it's pretty tough to see the economy grow at anything other than the sluggish pace that we've seen the past couple years. This year, it looks like over the course of the year, wage growth will be somewhere between end up between 2 and 2.5%, call it 2.3% maybe, when we get the final numbers in for this year. You've got inflation running at something less than 2%. That's not much of a margin there to increase consumption. We know you can't turn on the TV these days without reading about the manufacturing recession that's going on in America. If you're Caterpillar or Deere or somebody like that, you're laying off people, and that obviously is not helping wage growth from that perspective. So it's just good old-fashioned consumption by the U.S. citizen that's going to get us any kind of growth, if we are going to grow faster than the 2% rate that we've talked about. Lately, the past couple of months, wage growth has been running a little bit higher than that. It's running more between 2.5 and 3. If you look at just the very recent numbers, although it's very choppy, there is some evidence that things are improving there. as I mentioned earlier, you've got unemployment at what historically has been very low rates at 5%, and anticipated that that unemployment rate is going to go lower into the high fours, 4.7, 4.8 over the next couple years. So those are sorts of things that would indicate that wage growth is out there. But what we also know is that a lot of these jobs are service jobs. They're not likely to get big pay increases. So that makes you wonder how much is really realistic to expect, how much growth is realistic to expect. The consumer recently has shown an inclination to save money rather than to spend it. Saving rates are rising. If they are spending money, they typically just spend it on a car and not much else. So it's fairly limited in their consumption habits. So it's very difficult, given the Fed's expectation of 2% inflation, to come up with anything that's much higher than that 2.5% to 3% expectation. And that's good enough to keep us on the trajectory that the economy has been on recently. But it's not anywhere near the historical standards that we would use to call a recovery, you know, robust or an above average recovery. So if we're going to see great things in the economy, it's going to have to come from the consumer, and it's going to have to come from better wage growth and more spending by the consumer.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff. I guess, one issue that I kind of thought somebody might bring up is the election. We have a big election at the end of the year. John, any thoughts? Is that going to be market moving? Is it just noise? How does that impact things?
Well, it may not be noise, but I guess let's say that Hillary Clinton wins the presidency. In a sense, I guess it would be business as usual. Now, you can argue that if it is business as usual, that may not be particularly attractive, considering what's happened in the last 4 or 5 years. If the Republican candidate, whomever that happens to be, wins, then there could be some significant changes that might have impacts in various areas of the industrial world and perhaps even internationally. By the way, when we've been thinking about the election, I'm reminded of the socionomics people, and that's just people who study social trends and social moods and use those to project movements in the economy and stock markets and interest rates and everything else. The idea is that the social mood really drives everything, and the social mood now is angrier than it used to be. And if the market happens to have, let's say, a bad period between now and the end of 2016, or between now and the election has a bad period, considering the mood that's turning more and more negative as we speak, it could have an impact on the election to the point we want somebody really, really different. And at that point, Hillary Clinton and the Democrats would probably lose, given the history of the socionomic projections and their analysis. And whoever the Republican candidate is will win. And in their opinion, it doesn't matter when these things happen and the social mood changes and the market is poor, blah, 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 blah. Whoever the other guy is or the other woman is gets elected. It doesn't really matter. The populace really doesn't think about a lot of the detail. They just want to change, and they vote for somebody. So we'll see how it works out. But certainly, living in these unsettled times economically and politically, it's hard to imagine anything happening that next year, I guess, that would be settling, I guess, from the standpoint of making everybody feel particularly good. So we're probably in for another interesting year to go along with all the other interesting years we've had recently.
Okay. Thanks for those comments. Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the stock market. And, you heard Luther's comments earlier. The S&P 500 was really the big winner. But as you kind of dissect things as Luther did, removing some of those really big stocks that drove the market, that S&P 500 number really masked a lot of difficulties that took place in many other segments of the market. including, you know, as Luther mentioned, the other 490 stocks are equal weighted. Let's talk about the winner, the other winner, and that was large cap growth stocks, as you might imagine with, you know, the technology names that he mentioned really kind of leading the way. They were up 5.7%. And there was a big disparity between large growth and large value. Large value was down 3.8%. So you almost had a 10% differential, which is pretty uncommon to see that wide of a spread between value and growth. And then it gets really ugly from there. When you look at international stocks, the All Country World Index was down 5.2%. In emerging markets, really, you know, drove those numbers down 16.2% for the year. Developed countries did a little bit better when you add in dividends. They almost were positive, just slightly negative at 0.2%. Small cap stocks down almost 5%, so difficult year in the small cap space. And just to give you a little bit more color on the difficulty of the year, I have a monitor that I follow with key exchange-traded funds that try to replicate the returns of different market indices. And there's probably 60 different asset classes represented on that monitor. And when you look at the 2015 results, it's really just a sea of red. You know, there might have been, I think, 10 different asset classes that did well, a lot of them sector-specific, particularly in the consumer space. And then, of course, anything related to large cap growth did well. One last statistic that I want to share before I turn it over to Luther. This was a Bianco piece. And there are four major asset classes that have history going back to 1926. And it's the S&P 500, long-term treasury bonds, the cash or a three-month treasury bill, and then commodities. And if you look back going all the way to 1926, this year was the worst in terms of what the best return was since 1937. So we're talking 78 years since we had a situation. When you look at those four asset classes, what was the best return? You have to go 78 years back, and it was the third worst in history as far back as you can go. So, you know, that gives you a little bit more color on the difficulty experienced everywhere except for in, you know, S&P 500 large cap growth. So, Luther, I'm going to turn it over to you now. Maybe give us a little deeper dive on sectors if you could.
Yeah, I can do that, but let me add one thing first, is that like you said, most asset classes last year were negative or flat. The only asset class that really did well last year that kind of factored into our comments about the Fed is that the dollar was up almost 10% last year.
Okay.
But if you look at the S&P 500 and the 10 economic sectors, there were five sectors that were negative, five sectors that were positive. For the most part, the positive sectors were growth stocks, and the negative sectors were value stocks. The only asset class or sector that had a return of greater than 10% for the year was consumer discretionary, and this covers all the asset classes from the dollar to the Russell to the S&P to the EFA, everything. Consumer discretionary had the best return at 10.11, and that is because, as I mentioned earlier, Netflix and Amazon both doubled during the course of the year, and they are in that particular sector. That sector was followed by healthcare, up 6.89%. And in healthcare, you had some takeovers, and then you had some stocks with some new drugs. So a little bit of a stock-specific or industry-specific movement there. And then the last one was consumer staples. And although Walmart had its worst year in four decades, other stocks such as Hormel, Monster Beverage, and Constellation Brands helped push that sector up. On the negative side, it does get very ugly. Energy stocks in general were down 21%. Materials were down 8% because of the decline in commodity prices, just like with energy. And utilities were down almost 5% in anticipation of rising interest rates. So from the best sector to the worst sector, you have a 30% differential in return, which is rather large. But it was a very mixed bag last year, and like I said, if you weren't in the right space at the right time, you didn't have a good year regardless of the asset class.
Okay. Thank you, Luther. All right, well, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about our outlook for stocks in 2016. And the last couple of years, we've used the format in which John kind of gives the bearish case, Greg gives the bullish case, and I think we're going to do that again this year. And I think one big difference is that a lot of the strategists that we follow, I think there's a lot more in the bear camp this year, John. And why don't you go ahead and kind of, you know, talk a little bit about the bearish case and maybe work through some possible scenarios if you could.
Okay. Some of the data I have here that I was looking at this morning goes back to what Greg and Luther have already talked about in terms of market breadth. If you look at some of the major indices, not only the S&P 500, but the Russell 3000 that includes just about every stock that's traded on a public exchange in the United States, and the Russell 2000, which is a small cap index, and you look at those from an equal weighted basis, you find that something like 50-55% of the stocks in those indexes are down 20% or more from their 52-week highs. So there is a bear market of sorts going on in these different indices that is not really completely recognized in the index itself. And of course, as we have said today, and as I'm sure a lot of our listeners know, the capitalization-weighted indices, that concept means that certain stocks, because of their market value, the shares outstanding times the current price in the marketplace, are so high they dominate the index value. And there are 50 stocks in the S&P that tend to really control that index over time. And, you know, similar numbers are do the same thing in the Russell 3000 and the Russell 2000. Well, there's no gain in 2 years in the Russell 3000 index or the Russell 2000 index, and that's been the case for a lot of the indexes. Say, for the last 18 months, 2 years, you've experienced a lot of volatility, but the indexes themselves haven't gone anywhere, and they've been held up primarily by some of the large cap stocks and the growth stocks, of course, in the S&P 500 that have done so well in the past year. That type of situation, in the face of relatively modest economic growth, which seems to be decelerating, questionable earnings data in terms of estimates for next year, and relatively poor valuation, suggests that you are in a bearish environment of some sort. Now, we never know exactly what a bearish environment means. Maybe that's a relatively broad trading range with stocks not really making any perceptible new highs for a long time, or perhaps it indicates that you have another significant decline in prospect in the major indices. Now, historically, when you have seen a technical picture like we have today, and coupled with the economic backdrop that we see, before the bearish trend, which, and we've certainly been in one of some sort for the last couple of years, before that is over, you normally see some further decline in the major indices as people finally give up hope for the major stocks that have been driving everything recently. They begin to sell, you finally get the bottom in everything, and then you start a new cycle. Now, whether we're there or not, of course, is still up for conjecture, but the general picture is one that is relatively negative compared to what you would like to see. And it suggests to me that being somewhat cautious is better than being somewhat aggressive in this kind of environment.
All right, Greg. I guess, you know, for a change, we talked about the consensus is probably a little bit more bearish. Give us some reasons to be optimistic for the market in 2016.
Yeah, I think it was a little more of a formidable task this year. Not to mention that I was out for the holidays, so it was a quick look. But I think in general, you know, although the U.S. has started to raise interest rates, but the global slowdown, other global economies, while we're actually beginning to tighten, they're still slowing or, you know, look to be slowing. So I think it's fairly certain, at least in my opinion, that monetary policy on a global basis will remain pretty accommodative. And I think in many ways. You know, we've argued in the past over the last couple of years while the Federal Reserve in the U.S. was doing quantitative easing that that accommodative monetary policy was probably propping up stock markets. And I can't help but think that possibly, you know, with a stronger dollar, higher rates, that some of that money may find its way to the shores on the U.S. Another thing, if you look at studies done either by Ned Davis or Crandall Pierce, and you look at, you know, inflation is still very benign, and we're at, you know, low interest rates. Even if the Fed does raise rates, say, 3 to 4 times over the course of next year, we're still at extremely low interest rates. And if you look historically, that P-E ratios tend to be inversely correlated. That means that if rates are low, P-E multiples tend to be high. And if you look at right now the P-E multiple on the forward-looking basis for the S&P 500, it's around 16 times earnings. Now, that's not necessarily cheap, but it's a little bit cheaper than it was. And historically, you know, I think the historical on a forward is probably about 14 times. But, again, it's not outrageously expensive. So, again, history suggests that higher P.E. multiples are supported by low inflation, low interest rates. So we've probably seen what we call multiple expansion, where the P.E. actually increases over time, and that that could propel stock prices, you know, higher. Now, given that P.E. ratio right now at 16, it's, you know, it's probably not another, it's not going to be a 30% year, but it does provide perhaps some basis or at least, you know, an argument that stocks could still go up. Another alternative, and again, you know, certainly as a firm, it's not one of the best reasons to make an argument for stocks that, you know, we've talked about this before, but it goes back to that acronym I think we've used on calls before called TINA. What are the alternatives? You know, we've had one interest rate increase, but that hardly makes money market funds attractive. It certainly hasn't really done much for bond returns. And again, investors are looking for relative value or relative performance. So, you know, even if the Fed does raise rates 3 or 4 more times, it's still, I think, a hard argument to make, in my opinion, that CDs, money markets, bond investments are competitive alternatives to stocks. And, of course, that all has to be couched within your own risk profile. Obviously, the older you are, the less time you have to make things up, the less you want to be exposed to stocks. So, you know, I do want to qualify that. And certainly there's going to be bumps along the way. I think, you know, as we've seen, international markets can, you know, wreak havoc in ours. And so, you know, if we see some unknown situations, it could be a problem. Now, while I was doing a little bit of research and putting together what I wanted to talk about, I also ran across some economic statistics that are in a positive trend, and I think, you know, perhaps supporting a continued recovery, because we do hear a lot of, you know, bad things about the economy, but overall, consumer real expectations, they're up in a positive trend from a bottom low in 2012. Real median family income, which, you know, Jeff was referring to, we need to see the consumer participate because our GDP is 70% consumption, so we want people buying things. And I haven't seen the final retail numbers from the holiday season, but I know malls and actual brick-and-mortar stores did, you know, somewhat poorly, but online sales went through the roof. I know I had ordered some things online, and it was supposed to be a 2-day delivery, and it took over a week to get. So they were, you know, UPS and FedEx were overwhelmed. Real disposable income is up from a low in 2014. Small business employment is up from a 2010 low. Retail sales are up from basically from a 2009 low. Household formations are up from a 2009-2010 low. Manufacturing industrial production, excuse me, has been in a rising trend, actually, for the last 6 years. And also real capital expenditures have also been rising for the last 6 years. So lastly, I think historically stocks have done reasonably well in a rising rate environment. In fact, a study by Crandall Pierce shows that stocks do considerably better in a rising rate environment than they do in a declining rate environment. And their argument goes is that rates would not be going up. The Fed would not be raising rates unless the economy was doing considerably better, because generally Fed policy starts to lower rates as they feel like the economy is faltering. So that would be my case for a positive outlook on stocks. Probably not a big bang-out year, but I think you could make that argument if that suits your risk profile.
Okay. Hope you're right, Greg.
Yeah, me too. By the way, Dave, I'll throw one other thing in there. When we all know that making forecasts is pretty difficult, and sometimes if not impossible. But I think on these calls, most of the time we try to make some reasoned projections. But I'll just throw this out for interest. When investors pick up the Wall Street Journal or some other major media publication and look at projections for the next year, if you've done this over a number of years, you will notice that the projections are always positive. You know, nobody ever predicts a recession. Nobody ever predicts a bear market. It's just simply that, for one thing, it's hard to do, and for the other thing, nobody likes to talk about negative things in the first place. But the interesting statistic is that if for calendar years, I think since 1900, if you were to project a positive year going forward, you'd be right 70% of the time. So if you wonder why you sometimes see always positive numbers, if everybody's aware of these numbers, they know that they have a 70% chance of being right. So maybe we should have just said that and nothing else.
All right. Thank you, John. Let's try and quickly move to fixed income, because I do have quite a few questions I'd like to tackle if possible. And Jeff and Luther, really, and I'm going to weave in one of the questions that we have. First, let's talk about outlook on long-term rates. We've talked about at length the Fed and what's going to happen to the short end of the curve. Let's talk about our outlook on long-term rates. And the question that I received that I'll ask you to fit in is that as the Fed continues to raise rates, doesn't that in turn cause inflation to be muted? And as a result, the long end of the curve is, more a function of inflation expectations. Does that, in fact, drive long-term yields down, flattening out the yield curve? So kind of fit both the answers into those questions, if you could.
Sure. I'll start out. This is Jeff. That's correct. People think of interest rates as one homogenous number, but it's really not. It's an array of numbers spread over short-term maturities to long-term maturities. So short-term rates can rise while long-term rates don't rise. And we've seen that. It's pretty common, especially when an economy is going into a recession. But to answer the question, the Fed has come out and said they're going to raise, as we said, four times this year, four times next year. Let's just assume that they don't do quite that much, that they raise half as much. They raise 50 basis points this year and 50 basis points next year. That 1% increase doesn't necessarily have to translate into a 1% increase, say, in 10-year securities. Again, that's largely 10-year securities are largely a result of long-term inflation expectations. Now, I'll tell you that typically 10-year securities trade about 1.5 to 2 percentage points above the rate of inflation. So, and that's a historical number. As we know, this time around, things aren't exactly as history would say they are. But I guess my opinion is the Fed is raising rates, but that will have the impact of slowing the economy and actually will ultimately lower inflation, which means that long-term rates don't rise nearly as much as short-term rates. They will go up, no question about that, but they will not go up nearly as much. So, it just depends on how resilient the economy is to the Fed increase. But it's not an automatic fact that long-term rates are going to rise in lockstep with short-term rates. Luther, what's your opinion on that one?
Well, I think you've hit it right on the head there, and that what we'll see is a flattening yield curve, is that short-term rates will continue to rise, not in lockstep with Fed funds, but close, and then you'll see a little bit further out the curve, rates continue to rise. And, you know, maybe if the Fed raises rates 1% over the course of the next 18 months, you'll see, you know, intermediate-term rates up 25 to 50 basis points, and maybe the same for the long end. But most of that will impact the shorter end, the 5 years and then. So we'll see a yield curve that doesn't pay you for going out long, and you get better interest rates on the short end, at least for now. But we'll have to wait and see how all those numbers come in, because, as you said, raising rates will import deflation. We'll just have to see how much stronger the dollar can really be.
Okay. Thanks, guys. One other question regarding fixed income before we move on to some of the questions that were submitted. Best performing fixed income asset classes. We've neglected to mention munis. Munis had a great year last year. Are they also going to be a top performer next year? Give me your thoughts on that.
This is Luther again. Yeah, last year, munis, particularly the long muni bond index, or the aggregate market was up just over 3%, which crushed just about everything else, you know, twice the return on treasuries and agencies and mortgages, and better than corporate bonds also, and this is, you know, a tax-exempt income. Given the supply-demand factors going forward, the fact that there are no longer, or at least right now, any plans to reduce the tax-exempt status of municipal bonds, declining supply and increasing demand, I think you'll continue to see municipals do fairly well. Overall credit quality is good. It's getting better, but also slowly. This doesn't mean to say that there won't be issues out there like Puerto Rico, but for the most part, I think munis will have another decent year this year.
Jeff, anything there? What about high yield?
Well, obviously high yield had a tough year because a fairly large component of that index is in oil and gas related and coal and commodity related. So it was a tough year for high yield all the way around. We also know a lot of the retailers were high yield financed with high yield bonds. Retail is also suffering because of some of the issues that Greg talked about earlier. So I expect if oil can find a bottom, then you'll see a dramatic improvement in high yield securities. People don't like uncertainty, and right now there's no certainty around what the ultimate bottom is going to be in the price of oil. So until we find that, it's impossible to predict when high yield will bottom. But if that does happen, I would look for high yield to see a pretty significant rally at that point.
All right, great. We'll try and answer just a couple of these questions quickly, and I'm going to tackle the first one. The first one that came in was regarding valuation of, we talked about FANG or the really large companies in the index. Just looking at Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Alphabet, the price-to-earnings ratio for those four names closed the year at 60 times. Started the year roughly about 40 times, and then looking at price to sales, started somewhere around 4, and now are at a multiple of 5.5. So you do see people paying a premium for those names and for their earnings. You know, is it too much? Are they too expensive? Time will tell. But when you compare that to the rest of the market, obviously a multiple of 60 compared to the 16 or so where we are on the general market is a pretty significant premium priced into those particular names. The other question, John, I'll throw this one to you or anyone else that wants to put their 2 cents in. We talked a lot about declining prices, whether it be commodities, oil, just kind of across the board, low inflation. But to the everyday consumer going to the grocery store, they don't seem to – seems like prices keep going up. What's the disconnect there? Any thoughts?
I don't know, Dave. It's the basic commodity prices are certainly down, and I'm really not up to speed on what the selling prices are in the grocery stores. Maybe it depends on what grocery store you go to. I'm not really sure about that, but certainly the commodity prices are down. You know, what the markup is and so forth, I'm not sure, but, you know, consumption spending generally, of course, is relatively moderate compared to past recoveries. So, but I don't really know. Maybe someone else has a thought on that.
But, John, you mentioned that, like, what was it, orange juice or cocoa, sugar, those products were
actually. Yeah, those are up, yeah.
Those are all up, and that may have had an impact on that because we know there's a lot of sugar in all those foods.
Yeah, that's true. It probably depends on what your buying habits are like, just like your inflation cost. You know, what's, you know, my CPI is totally different from somebody else's CPI. So,
of course, I think economically it's the hard commodities that, you know, are taking the hit. Food, I think, is a fairly consistent demand item. You know, it's a consumable. And so, just because the economy goes down, people still have to eat. So I think that could be why, you know, they're still remaining firm or even going up.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground. Thank you, everybody, for attending today. Please join us next month when our call will be on Tuesday, February 2nd. Thank you.